Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we discuss access to mental health care. Millions of Americans with mental illness struggle to find care. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, despite passage of a federal mental health parity law in 2008, significant barriers exist in accessing mental health treatment. Here in studio to talk about some of the barriers in various disciplines, social worker Anne Gagan. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning.
Hello.
And psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mindy.
And on the phone, we have State Senator Julian Sear. Last week, the State Senate unanimously passed the Mental Health ABC Act, which now moves on to the House. Good morning, Senator Sear.
Good morning, Mindy.
So this legislation is aimed at removing barriers and increasing access, and it's a lot in here. Just kind of summarize, if you will, what this legislation is looking
for. Sure. You know, too many people in Massachusetts struggle to access mental health services they desperately need and they deserve. And the reasons are many and they're intricate. Mental health care is treated differently than physical health. It's often not covered by insurance. It's difficult to access, and it's hard to talk about. And so what the Senate has done by taking up this pretty comprehensive legislation is we're laying the foundation to truly live up to a promise that Senate President Karen Spilka has made, that we're going to transform how the Commonwealth addresses mental health. The legislation kind of has three big buckets. I'm glad to go through it. There's a significant parity component and other insurance reforms. We're planting the seeds for the workforce that we're going to need, and we're looking at access issues. The other thing, though, that we've done is that, you know, part of why mental health care folks aren't getting the care they need is because it's hard to talk about. And so what we've sought to do in the Senate is talk about our own experiences with mental health, whether on our families and our own lives. And so that's really kind of part of this legislative package, even though it's not sort of explicitly in the legislation.
Yeah, and we're going to get into some specifics in that. First, I want to bring in our panel here and talk about, this is one of the reasons we do this program, right? Because these are mental illness and health care is difficult to talk about.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of need out there. And Senator Sear just kind of talked about some of the barriers. And what do you see with your patients? I mean, what are you hearing from them as far as barriers?
First off, I think we ought to define a lingo term that maybe not everybody knows, and that's the word parity, what that means. It means fairness, treating mental health conditions exactly in the same pattern with the same parameters that we treat medical conditions, diabetes or high blood pressure or whatever the condition is, that the healthcare providers are reimbursed the same way that the family practitioners are or the specialists are when they're doing the same kind of thing, not when we're doing psychiatrists don't do surgery or something like that, then they shouldn't be reimbursed the same as a surgeon per hour. There should be an equal access to psychiatric care or mental health care, just as there is an equal access to your family care doctor.
And I think people probably listening would be surprised to hear that that's not the case.
That's not the case.
Yeah. And how different is
it? It never has been. Yeah. The other thing, it's got a long history of mental health has had a long history of being discriminated against. The parity law was passed federally in 2008, and it was never lived up to, and still isn't, because the insurance companies have ways of getting around it to make it harder to access care. Because you have to realize that you're when you're trying to access mental health care, at least in terms of the insurance world, you've got an enemy there. Because when you access care, they call it a loss. That's a business loss for them to pay out. And they use the language. They protect against loss. So if they have procedures in place that delay care, even delay it to the point that you don't bother getting it, or you get so frustrated that you pay out of pocket, that's good for them. We're in a... there's an adversary relationship in some ways between the patient population and the payer population. That's why there's so much argument toward government takeover or Medicare for all.
What are we talking about when you look at reimbursements? How different, I mean, how much of a discrepancy is there between
Well, if you just look at the reimbursements between a psychiatrist who is an MD, who's gone to medical school and then got residency training in the field of psychiatry, just like an internist goes to medical school and then they get residency training in internal medicine or a pediatrician, the same thing. So we've gone to medical school and we've had a residency program and we have privileges just like a family care doctor would. However, we're probably reimbursed on average about 20% less for the same procedure. We use procedure codes when we bill insurance code, insurance companies. They're numbers that codes are numbers that reflect the complexity of a visit, how involved it is, how complicated it is, how much decision making there is. Certain parts of the exam are included. Well, the codes are the same for general medicine and for psychiatry. The general medical doctors get paid about 20% more for the various codes.
Yeah. Senator Steere, the parity is in this legislation. And how, you know, we just mentioned that we had this federal legislation passed 2008 and nothing really happened. How do we ensure that the parity here in this state, is enforced?
So actually, Massachusetts has had parity laws in the books since 2000. And what the legislation essentially does is we put in place a whole host of reporting requirements, transparency requirements. We give the Department of Insurance, which is the regulating agency here, more teeth around enforcement, higher penalties. We explicitly say that the majority of insurance companies actually subcontract out their mental health and behavioral health benefits to what are called behavioral health management entities, otherwise known as carve-outs. So we're very explicit about them as well. What we're essentially doing is recognizing that both the state laws, it's been on the books for 20 years, and federal parity have not actually actualized their intent. Mm-hmm. And so we essentially go through and clarify a whole litany of aspects that make them very explicit, therefore making it harder to sort of get around that coverage. We also look at prior authorization and medical necessity. We eliminate what's called prior authorization. Prior authorization meaning the permission that a provider needs to get from the insurance company to render that care. We eliminate that for acute inpatient services. And then we set up a panel to look at what's called medical necessity, meaning who is determining whether or not a patient needs a given service. In many cases, sure that's doing that, not the treating clinician. And so we want to change that. So the bill does that as well. But this is essentially sort of the most ambitious law in the country in making explicit parity. So essentially we've learned from the lack of clarity we had in both the federal and state laws.
Yeah. And you mentioned this conversation that you're having with your fellow senators, and you've publicly shared your own personal struggle with anxiety and depression and how therapy has helped you.
Yes. Yeah, so, I think what's really important, and the Senate president has exemplified this, is talking about how mental health, touches all of us. And I've seen this even since we've taken up the bill, how many people have come up to me or sent me notes or messages and said, this is me, this is my family. You know, for me, I'm someone who's struggled with anxiety and depression since adolescence. From an early age, people knew I was different, especially in school. I was bullied. I had panic attacks. At one point, I developed an eating disorder. And really, I have sort of struggled with anxiety, even as recent as when I did a kind of ridiculous thing, which was run for state senate in 2016 as a 30-year-old from the smallest town on Cape Cod. But, the reason I tell this story is because therapy has helped me manage my anxiety and do things I never dreamed I could. And yet I still can't get my health insurance to cover my outpatient mental health care, particularly when I sort of move from being on state health insurance as an employee of the state. I left that job to run for state senate. I kind of was on a myriad of different insurers. I'm a pretty savvy consumer, Mindy. I mean, I'm a 34-year-old state senator. I was a policy wonk in healthcare before this. If I can't navigate this system, and if I don't know how to get around these barriers to accessing care, imagine how many people in the Commonwealth can't get the care they desperately, need and they deserve. And so that's why I've really been upfront about talking about this because I think it just reflects how broken our system is, as well as working to sort of open up and sort of combat stigma and just talking more, making this policy more personal.
Yeah, and I imagine that you all hear that from your patients, the frustration they have with insurance, right?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to ask the senator if he has a top 10 of the barriers that he's struggled with over the years.
No, that's a good one, yeah.
So I think, you know, both in my own experience and then, you know, as we sort of sunk our teeth into the policy, I find just people don't know where to start. You know, even a friend the other day was like, hey, you know, I'm feeling kind of down. I want to see someone. Like, how do I start this, right? And so there's no clear front door to get access to care, whether you're looking for, you know, maybe some outpatient treatment, or even to the extent where, you know, you need, you know, you're having a pretty acute psychosis. The only place that you go is the emergency department, and you often have to literally wait and sit there for not hours, not, you know, but days, sometimes weeks, to get access to beds. You know, so patients are struggling to find a provider. They find it challenging to afford those providers, many of whom don't take insurance. About half of psychiatrists in the Commonwealth don't even accept any insurance. So, right, we're not talking about not accepting MassHealth. We're talking about not accepting any insurance. Mm. You know, and then often when someone can find someone who's a provider who can then, you know, who then takes their insurance, they often have to wait weeks for an appointment. So we've got to do a lot, yes, to make health insurance more attractive for providers, but it's more than just rates. A lot of it is just the administrative burdens. It can take, you know, double the time that a clinician would take with a patient just to fill out the paperwork. So that's why in the bill we mandate a universal credentialing form, meaning that there's one form that every single provider in the Commonwealth can use to submit to an insurer to get on their panel, and the insurance company has to respond within 20 days. This sounds remarkably simple and kind of like, you know, it's like 2020. Why don't they do this already? This will make a huge difference in getting more providers to take insurance and in retaining those insurers.
Yeah. I wonder if anybody has any thoughts on this. On, you know, you would think you feel like you need some help, you might go to your primary care physician, mm-hmm. right? And your primary care physician would refer you. But this statistic's a little bit old, but this one's 2/3 of primary care physicians cannot obtain outpatient mental health services for patients who need them. And I'm wondering if that's still the case. That was, I think, a stat from about 2005. Senator Sear, do you have any thought on that? Are primary care physicians struggling to find help for their patients?
So I think we know this is true, and I think that statistic does seem to hold. What we're trying to think about, you know, if you're looking at kind of like the broader themes within healthcare, we've seen this real consolidation of healthcare occurring in, you know, most of our healthcare systems, right? Larger and larger hospital systems. You know, the days of sort of a sole practitioner, you know, family doc is sort of, you know, increasingly waning. But what we haven't seen is that similar consolidation happening within mental health care providers. They tend to be sole practitioners, and so they're not able to sort of keep up with the administrative burdens, all the sort of extra requirements that, you know, as we have a more and more complicated healthcare system, they simply can't keep up. The bill that we passed focuses a lot on workforce, incentivizing a workforce, and having that workforce co-located within existing primary care providers, right? Mm-hmm. So the ideal is, you know, I'm seeing my provider at Outer Cape Health Services, right? And I'm talking about I'm having a hard time. That they're able to say, hey, hang on a minute, you know, let's walk down the hall and you can go talk to someone, right? Mm-hmm. That's the ideal scenario. In the bill, we eliminate, there was a practice where insurers would deny reimbursement for services rendered on the same day. So we eliminate that. We work to sort of plant the seeds of a workforce embedded within primary care. There is a pilot program for a fellowship for psychiatric nurse practitioners to work in community health centers. There are a number of other pieces. We actually do a pretty extensive inventory of culturally competent providers. If you are someone who needs a Spanish language pediatric psychiatrist, for instance, there are very few in the Commonwealth, right? We need to change that. But first, we need to have an inventory of what those services are. And there's a number of other kind of pieces in the bill, but I think, you know, you're absolutely right that, you know, we've got to figure out how do we integrate mental health as much as we can into primary care, mm-hmm. and how do we treat mental health like all other health care.
Yeah, and it's, the community health centers seem to do a pretty good job of that in that, you know, we're looking back to that thought of stigma, and this was maybe 10 years ago, where they started, you know, giving the form to everybody when they came in for, you know, about trying to determine who might have some depression. And they were surprised at the statistics that they got back on patients they would not have thought were having, you know, this, the issue of depression. But you're going into one building. Nobody knows if you're there to see, you know, a mental health practitioner or, you know, you're there for a physical, which seems to that model seems to work pretty well. And that's kind of what you're describing, right?
Exactly. That, you know, we need to look, people's lives are busy. They don't know how to navigate getting access to care. We need to make it as easy as possible. There's also provisions in this bill that allow interim licensure for licensed mental health counselors. This is going to provide more mid-level providers. Currently, these folks, when they were going through part of their training, they couldn't reimburse for their services, meaning that whoever they're working for is taking a loss on them. Mm-hmm. We also have another pilot or a pipeline program to get more bachelor's degree graduates getting into master's level training where they're also working with community providers. You know, and then we begin to look at this broader idea around integration, which, you know, I want to give Governor Baker and Secretary Mary Lou Sutters, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, you know, a lot of credit in that they've been really talking about the need to integrate primary care, mental health services. We've been spending a lot of time thinking about that as well. And so we take a very big first step towards that. So a lot's going to need to happen in integration. But what we begin to do is in the data collection work that happens in the state, we mandate that the Center for Health Information and Analysis, which is sort of the data collection center agency for healthcare, they currently can't tell you, you know, how many people are receiving a given mental health service. Mm. We can tell you to a granularity how many cardiac caths and, you know, this protocol on that, on the medical surgical side. So they're going to begin to collect and analyze that data to define what mental health services are, and then we direct the Health Policy Commission and their annual cost trends hearings. This is the agency responsible for keeping Massachusetts, containing our healthcare costs, that they need to explicitly be talking about mental health and having a spotlight on mental health because, you know, so we're trying to figure out all the different places in this remarkably, you know, in a remarkably fragmented system, you know, how do you begin to integrate mental health throughout all of it from, you know, the visit with a primary care provider to, you know, the macro healthcare policy analysis that's being done at the state level.
Mm-hmm. There's a cost benefit to it, too.
Senator, this is Jonathan Schwartz. I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm in the New Bedford, Fall River area. And I first want to say that I hope you live long enough to make all of this happen, because I certainly am in agreement, having practiced, and I'm a native of New Bedford, and I've practiced in that area for 35 years, and I'm active both in publicly funded clinics as well as in private practice. So I have a lot of experience with every single problem that you're describing. There are so many disincentives to achieving the goals that you've set that any of us who are in this business would fully agree with. And I'm not even sure where to start, but I do think it's interesting to note that as large medical multi-specialty groups have grown over the last 10 and 20 years, such as the South Coast Hospital Groups or Hawthorne Medical or PrimaCare in the Fall River area, the one specialty that nobody has up until approximately 1 year ago, the one specialty that none of these groups have seen fit to integrate into their buildings is mental health. And the reason is very simple. And frankly, I've considered it to be a great blessing for myself, because instead of being swallowed up and now I have not become an employee of any of these groups. But of course, the reason that no one's ever reached out to me is because I don't make enough money for it to be terribly attractive to a group that has ENTs and pulmonologists and every other medical specialty there is. So I, unlike my friends and colleagues, have been left alone to operate without an electronic medical record that tortures me every day. And it's been a blessing. But I want to say one thing with regarding MassHealth and the state-funded plans, which I consider to be a huge disincentive on a daily basis among the many disincentives. And that is that if you have a MassHealth plan as a patient and you don't show up for your appointment, and by the way, the no-show rate for people who have MassHealth is much, much insanely higher than anybody who has a private insurance plan, you cannot be charged anything for your failure to appear for your appointment. As a matter of fact, 20 years ago, I resigned from MassHealth for that reason, because I didn't think it was fair to have no disincentive for a patient to fail to show up for an appointment. And I made the following agreement with all of my MassHealth patients. I said, I will see you for free every time you come for an appointment, unless you, but you will be charged if you fail to show up for an appointment, which was kind of like the inverse of what it was all about. And that worked for a while, but, you know, of course, that wasn't really, that's not a sustainable business plan for anybody. But there are so many things about the MassHealth system that disincentivize clinicians from actually being MassHealth providers. They have a more frequent audit rate for their traveling around and observe, you know, seeing their clinicians' notes. They're punitive in many ways in terms of their requirements for record keeping, much more so than Blue Cross Blue Shield, Harvard Pilgrim, Tufts, Fallon, even Aetna and Cigna, which are widely known to be the two worst commercial plans in the country. MassHealth goes out of its way to give clinicians all kinds of reasons not to be a MassHealth provider. Yeah. And I have to imagine that even in community health centers, which have a difficult enough time making a living and keeping, you know, keeping the doors open, it's really hard to operate in a system that causes you, literally is planned to cause you to bleed money.
You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about access to mental health care. And last week, the State Senate unanimously passed the Mental Health ABC Act, which now moves on to the House. With us in studio is social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrists Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Whaley, and on the phone, State Senator Julian Sear. Before the break, Dr. Schwartz was talking a little bit about MassHealth, and I'm sure that's something that you looked at when you were talking about this legislation. Do we have any thoughts on solving some of those problems, Senator Sear?
Sure. So, you know, I think Jonathan said, you know, I hope you live long enough to sort of see this see this come to pass, and I do too. I think that we're trying to be very honest about how fundamentally broken and fragmented this system is. This is bigger than one bill, and this is bigger than one session. And really, you know, thanks to Senate President Karen Spilka, who has made mental health her number one personal priority. And that's a huge deal, right? You know, mm-hmm. Massachusetts politics is not shouldn't be seen through a partisan lens. It's really about the big three, right? Who's the Senate President, the Speaker, the Governor. This is really, you know, putting mental health on the agenda that we're going to need to fix a myriad of issues. So there, you know, for the 20-odd crucial things that are in this bill, I have another list of 20 or 30 items that are not in it. And we're going to be coming back to it next session. We're going to be doing more in the budget and trying to do that. To the MassHealth piece, so we are very explicit about including MassHealth in all of the requirements around parity, including MassHealth around a number of other pieces around the insurance coverage, around emergency service providers, other pieces. In some instances, actually, from an acute perspective, I tend to hear actually that it's the MassHealth coverage that is the most comprehensive. Now, that's in an inpatient setting, certainly not in an outpatient setting. We begin to look at rates in this bill, which is a profoundly complicated area, but we begin to establish what's called a base fee schedule, and essentially saying that the base fee inputs for evaluation and management for psychiatry has to be equivalent to primary care. And so we're explicit about, you know, not only applying this to the commercial market, which is really only about 40% of insured people in the Commonwealth, but including it, you know, in other areas, including GIC, including MassHealth. So there's a lot more kind of work that's there. We need to raise the rates. We need to, you know, clarify administrative burdens, which applies to MassHealth. There's so much more to do here, and that's sort of the, you know, the bittersweet piece about getting to you know, craft and lead and work on such substantial legislation. There's always a number of things that you couldn't get done in the bill. But I'm really encouraged that there's a real commitment, you know, in the Senate that we're going to keep on coming back to this time and again, time and again. Mm-hmm. I'd also just add, I think the scrutiny around the carve-outs, of which MassHealth manages their benefits for mental health through a carve-out, I think are really crucial here, and it will probably also help make a difference on some of the issues that Jonathan was talking about.
Yeah. I got a couple of calls. Andrew's giving us a call from Edgartown. Good morning, Andrew.
Hi, good morning. My question is regarding, partial hospitalization programs. The biggest barrier that I find there is if you can get insurance to cover anything, they'll only cover the therapy portion, and the lion's share, $15,000-$20,000 per month, isn't covered at all because it's partial hospitalization, and I find that is a massive barrier, and I was wondering if there's anything in this bill that addresses those situations.
Yes. Do you want me to answer that?
Yes.
So, the bill establishes this special commission that I mentioned earlier around looking at medical necessity, which includes partial hospitalization. Part of why insurers have been able to get around a lot of this stuff is that there are not sort of definitive metrics that we can sort of manage that say, you know, in contrast to in a medical surgical space, right? So you present in the ED, in the emergency department, with a cardiac issue. There's a whole host of like metrics, right, that we can use. It gets squishy and more complicated when it comes to mental health. And so because of that, insurers and others, frankly, have been able to, both insurers and, you know, the provider systems, especially in large hospital systems, have been able to kind of be pretty squishy about what is medically necessary. Do we have to sort of take this patient? And looking at medical necessity, this is a very aggressive timeline within a year, getting all the stakeholders at the table to really figure out, you know, when it comes to, you know, partial inpatient or outpatient services or day programs and outpatient as well, that we're going to figure this out in a pretty quick timeline. We'll then come back and it'll likely be included in the subsequent legislation that we'll take up next session. So from an inpatient acute perspective, no prior authorization, medical necessity is determined by the treating clinician, and then when you get to partial inpatient, other step-down programs, we're going to be working in the next year to figure this out. I think there's a concern about putting in language that we don't fully understand that then again could be used folks to sort of get around that again, right. Which is what we don't want, which is what we had with parity. So I think this is an instance where sometimes we got to go a little more deliberatively to make sure that we're getting the right policy so that people are getting the services they need and they deserve.
Yeah, Andrew, thanks for the phone call.
Yeah, the caller, Edward, is raising the issue of how another aspect of how mental health is discriminated against, and that is the cost sharing for a patient is much higher for mental health services than it is for medical services. Mm-hmm. And the partial hospitalization and the numbers that he just mentioned is a gross example of that.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Mary is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Good morning, everybody. I'm an advanced practice psychiatric nurse, which probably most of your listeners don't know that title. Mm-hmm. It encompasses psychiatric nurse practitioners and psychiatric clinical nurse specialists. And I've been working for years since Senator Sear began to run. Been working with him on changing a law from the 1980s that has been changed by every other New England state that requires advanced practice psychiatric nurses to have psychiatrist supervisors, in quotes, in order to be able to prescribe medication. That regulation is so outmoded that most states have done away with it. But in Massachusetts, we haven't been able to do that. And what it means is that when our psychiatrists, who are aging and retiring, when the psychiatrists on the Cape age out or retire from their practice, the advanced practice psychiatric nurses can no longer prescribe medications for our patients. Mm-hmm. And there are probably more of us in practice than psychiatrists at this point.
I'd like to interrupt.
Know that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Mary, hold on a second. Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm a, as I said earlier, I'm a psychiatrist in the New Bedford Fall River area, and I currently supervise about 20, probably at this point, between 20 and 25 nurse practitioners, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and CNSs, and I have this conversation with them on a fairly regular basis. Actually, they bring it up with me, and they point out that every state around Massachusetts has abandoned the need for supervision. What I and I supervise nurse practitioners who are excellent and fabulous and actually know much more medicine than I do because they've been ICU nurses, or, you know, for 15 years before they became psychiatric nurse practitioners. And I also supervise people who are just out of their schooling to become a nurse practitioner. And what I would say is that I think that to abandon the need for supervision entirely would be a huge mistake that would result in a lot of malpractice, but that I would agree that once somebody's been out of their nurse practitioner training or their advanced, their CNS training for some period of time, maybe that's 5 years, maybe that's 6 years, some period of time, it would make sense to me to no longer be required to have that supervision. Yeah. But to say that somebody who, you know, let's say was a med-surg nurse and then went to BC or Northeastern or Regis for 18 to 24 months of training and then could go out and practice with a prescription pad without any supervision, I would strongly disagree with.
Yeah. State Senator Sue, do you want to chime in?
Mindy, your listeners are getting a taste of the what I like to call guild warfare, various professions kind of come into the legislature. And, right, it's all arguing about who can be reimbursed for what, who makes more money for what. Generally, doctors are very, very restrictive. Massachusetts has some of the most restrictive scope of practice laws in the country. I personally think it's a bit much. But they're getting a taste of sort of the issues we deal with on Beacon Hill every day. I'm so glad Mary called. Mary has helped me kind of shape my thinking on this issue and many others in mental health for quite some time. I'm a big proponent of making the changes that Mary is talking about. We've got to get more prescribers and more access to prescribers and providers. And frankly, it just takes too much time and money to make a psychiatrist, and particularly psychiatrists who have language skills. We spend a lot of time looking at, cultural competency, right? And that we know that when people can build trusting relationships with someone, they're going to get better outcomes for their mental health. Well, how many black and brown, psychiatrists do we have in the state who have a Spanish language skill or other cultural competency? So I think psychiatric nurse practitioners are a really important piece about how we're going to build this workforce. That's why there's a pilot program in this bill that's focused on psych NPs and community health centers. And to Mary's, the point that Mary brings up, the Senate's going to be taking up this issue, which we have done before, which we have passed before, in a subsequent bill that we're taking up in March. I believe it's going to be March. The way that the statute, the law, is structured around nurse practitioners is such that at one point we had thought that we were going to sort of isolate out psychiatric nurse practitioners and say, all right, we're going to sort of make this fix for them. But there were some concerns in what that would mean for broader NP practice. So we're going to be doing this. This is something the Senate's been on the record of doing. And I think it's really important about getting more, more providers who are providing this care that we desperately need. Of course, you need to have adequate training and a whole host of pieces we'll be looking at. But the Senate's been on record in support of this. And the only reason it was not in this bill is because it has broader implications to the practice of other NPs, and we felt it was more appropriate to do in a subsequent healthcare reform vehicle that's coming soon.
And before we let you go, we mentioned that this passed the Senate unanimously, and now this Mental Health ABC Act goes to the House. Any indication as to when the House might take this up and if it will pass?
So reading tea leaves is always a complicated business on Beacon Hill. The deadline that we have is July 31st, of course, to conduct, you know, to finish all of our formal business. I'm really fortunate that I have a tremendous partner in the House on these issues in Representative Marjorie Decker, who's my co-chair of the Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use, and Recovery. We're hoping that the committee is going to be putting out a bill that I chair and that she and I chair on more focused on children in the coming weeks. And so I'm optimistic we can get something taken up in the House and then reconcile this. I will say the response that we have gotten from this bill has been just overwhelming. You know, I had a colleague come up to me after we passed the bill. You know, he served for at least a good 10 years in the Senate. And, you know, he said to me, he's like, Julian, I think this is the best bill I've ever voted on. I mean, we need to do more things like this. So I think, you know, anyone who kind of looks at this issue knows that we have so much to do to fix this broken, fragmented mental health care system. I feel this is a really good start with acknowledging that we've got a lot more to do. And I'm optimistic and hopeful that, you know, our allies and colleagues in the House will see this as well, and we can get this done. Also strong support from the Baker-Polito administration. Many of the ideas that was put out in the governor's health care reform bill are the same ideas that we had and have been included there. So I think there's a lot of consensus on this, and I hope that means that we can get something reconciled, because this issue is just too important, and we've got to get this bill passed so we can work on the next bill.
Okay. State Senator Julian Sear, I know you have to run. Thanks so much for spending some time with us this morning. We appreciate
for including
that.
Me in this, and thank you for doing this show monthly, because I think this issue is just
thank you for your service.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about access to mental health care. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. One of the things I think that is the system is very confusing, as we've been hearing, and complicated. But what about, you know, you think maybe I need some help, and, you know, there's a lot of choices, right? Do I need a social worker? Do I need a psychologist? Do I need a psychiatrist? Maybe we could talk a little bit about what the different disciplines do and what kinds of patients they see.
Well, ideally, the person should walk into a door and get triaged, so to speak, by whoever they're talking to first, and triaged, in other words, sorted out and referred to the discipline, at least, that will best suit their needs. The common model and the standard of care, really, in mental health is to have psychotherapy combined with medication, at least evaluation for medication. If you're I think some general guidelines can apply. If you have a strong family history of mental illness and or mental difficulties, and you've had previous episodes of it, and you know what works, what doesn't work for you, you obviously follow those paths. But the more sort of biological you can sense that the disorder is based, you really ought to see a medical professional and have that done early in your career as a seeking mental health care. But a lot of times it's not needed. And there are conditions that psychotherapy, which is done primarily by the people that are other than MDs at this point in time, we can talk about the different disciplines and the differences of them. A lot of times psychotherapy is best for you. And some people don't like the idea of swallowing pills, of giving over something of control to what they feel is a pill. The therapist, if that's the route that the person takes, should keep in mind that there might be some times that medication is helpful and they're ignoring a potentially helpful tool. And the psychotherapy should then focus on why they're resisting.
I would say also that one of the points of confusion is that there's a great deal of overlap among the skill sets of different credentials. So, for example, an LICSW, an LMHC, a psychiatrist, and a psychologist may all be trained in doing psychotherapy. whether or not which of those people perhaps you should see if indeed psychotherapy is the correct form of treatment for you. It really depends largely on what names you've gotten from your friends, your family members, who you saw in the phone book on the internet. I'm still amazed that sometimes people will come to see me because they're telling me that they got my name on the internet. Mm-hmm. Also, the reality is that most people, when they're seeking help, they don't actually have a way of knowing what form of help is best for them. So, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is distinctly different from what, in my mind anyway, from psychotherapy. People have an idea of the sort of Freudian kind of chit-chat where you're talking about your childhood and your relationship with your mother. And for some people, psychotherapy of that sort can be very profoundly helpful. But for a lot of people, particularly people who have anxiety disorders, people who have mild depression, and for a lot of other forms of illness, cognitive behavioral therapy is really the most cost-efficient, effective way to get back your health without the use of medication. What you really want is a resource that can give you a fair, unbiased opinion on what type of help, you know, is really best suited to you. And most of the time when people pick up the phone and call a mental health center or call a group practice, you know, they may ask for some particular kind of help, but it's only because they don't actually, they have an idea that, I'm looking for a therapist or I'm looking for a psychiatrist. Well, do they need to see a psychiatrist compared to a psychiatric nurse practitioner? Mm-hmm. It's really, it's hard to know when you're not a sophisticated consumer.
Right. Anne?
Well, I was going to say, you just mentioned, Jonathan, about they got your name off the internet. I get a lot of my referrals from the internet because of a site called Psychology Today, and practitioners can put their profile on Psychology Today, and you list not only your specialties and where you're located, and where what insurance you cover or can receive reimbursement from. So many people, that's where they begin. Mm-hmm. And so they go through this, they put in their zip code a lot. I mean, here's where you start, you know, people come, well, you're in my area, so I'm going to come see you. Mm-hmm. And from there, it pulls up practitioners who are in their area or have their specialty. There's many ways of approaching this. I think that's effective because that's where people are. They can eliminate the practitioners that don't have their insurance or don't have their specialty. So that is a resource that anyone can use. And then, of course, once the person calls or walks in the door, one as a practitioner, you have to look at whether you're a good fit, mm-hmm. not only from the practitioner's point of view, but mostly from the consumer's point of view, from the client's point of view, and that's a discussion.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And obviously finding out what brings them to care and what they hope to get out of it. Those are all things that obviously come in a good assessment. But I think it's really the way most of my referrals come now, and may not be perfect. They come from that, or they come from somebody who said they had good experience with their care.
Yeah. Sure.
So how do you know it's working or not working? You walk in, I walk into Ann's office, and I sit down and I talk to Ann, and whatever, let's say I'm there because I have anxiety or depression. When should I start to see some kind of results? And, you know, is it a personality thing? Do I say, I really like Ann, or I don't know if I like Ann so much?
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, that's part of it. You need to ask yourself, are you better? Are you better off today than you were before you started this process? And when you ask that, you should ask it all along the time, mm-hmm. even after the first visit, what your overall general feeling is. But are you closer to the goals that brought you there? Are you any closer? Or do you see, if you're not closer, then do you see a path that can get you closer? One thing I would caution people to, kind of raise a red flag is if the therapist that they're seeing or the psychiatrist uses the time to talk about themselves too much.
Oh, you're not supposed to do that?
Self-disclosure?
Yeah. Well, not so much self-disclosure. It's just the time is really for the patient. And when you think of what that is, that's really a unique experience in life. When do you have somebody's full attention for an hour? You know, there's no other relationship that you have that. Maybe maybe back in infancy, if you're lucky. But otherwise, when do you actually have somebody's full undivided attention who has your interest at heart, primarily? So if you start seeing signs that, that the therapist is drifting off into their own interests or their own agendas, you know, ideally, you should call them on it and you should correct it and take charge of your therapy. That would be the ideal thing. But otherwise, use your feet and vote that way.
One piece that's really important is chemistry. I mean, you should, when you walk in, even the first or second time that you see the person, you know, you should feel that they're really listening to you.
That's right.
They get who you are, and you feel comfortable that they're somehow, you know, on your same wavelength in a way that's really quite meaningful. That doesn't mean they've solved your problem or that you walk out of the office right away, you know, better off or with fewer symptoms, but that you feel really comfortable that this person is taking their job seriously and they really are concentrating, they're focusing on what you're saying. Sadly, of course, that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. When I'm making referrals to various kinds of therapists, I compare it to dating. You know, nobody can really know who you're going to be a great match with, but here's somebody who, you know, seems, you know, their skill set and their background seems to fit what you're looking for, and then you go and you see, and if the chemistry's not there, if it doesn't feel right, well, just give me a call and we'll move on to the next candidate.
Right. One of the things we were talking about that legislation is they're trying to get more practitioners, right? And we know that there's a shortage of psychiatrists. There's not enough psychiatrists to go around. Do you have any idea why that is? Why fewer people go into that? Is it to do with the reimbursements and all of the red tape?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It does. And also, people who go to medical school are obsessive a bit and scientifically oriented. And psychiatry has been, you know, kind of weak in that compared to other medical specialties. But especially, I think, psychiatry doesn't have procedures to do that are reimbursed at high rates. And nowadays, somebody coming out of medical school might have almost $300,000 in loans that they have to pay back, and they'd like to have a house finally when they're 30 years of age. So it kind of dictates people or pushes people away from psychiatry that way because of the vow to poverty. I would use the term. You take a vow to poverty when you go into the mental health field in some ways.
Okay, and that's not what people think, right?
No.
People think the complete opposite.
Yeah. No, but compared to other specialties in other areas of medicine, there's some limits. So there's a disincentive there. In the 60s, when I trained, there were about 10% of all medical school classes went into psychiatry. That was a time of enthusiasm and a time of we're going to make a difference in the world. That was the whole point of the 60s, riding on Kennedy's leadership in the early 60s. So there was that sense. And we're going to change things. And psychiatry was the best medical specialty, if you will, of social change. Perhaps after the 80s and greed becomes more important, that disincentivizes.
But, you know, even within the medical profession, mental health care is stigmatized. Physicians do look upon psychiatrists as second-class citizens, and they sort of think, well, anybody could do psychiatry. What I do, that's really tough.
That's real medicine.
Social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrists Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Whaley, always good to see you. Thanks. See you next month.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.